Committee on Transportation, February 19, 1987, 8 a.m., Hearing Room E. Work session, House Bill 2213. Public hearing and work session, House Bills 2160 and 2161. Public hearing on House Bill 2060 and 2061.
Transportation will come to order. Pamela, call the roll. Those that are absent are excused this morning.
Representatives Brigiotti.
Here.
Hayden.
Here.
Jolin. Norris.
Here.
Peterson.
Here.
Young.
Here.
Witte.
Here. First item of business is our friend 2213, which is not yet back with us, but it's on the agenda. I'm going to make a motion, and the majority of the members present will allow us to bring this bill back. I move that the committee reconsider the February 12, 1987 vote, whereby House Bill 2213 was reported from this committee with a due pass as amended recommendation to the floor of the House. Discussion.
No, Mr. Chairman, I don't understand what we're doing here.
Well, this is the bill that we took to the floor. Representative Young carried it.
No.
And we
it's not that bill. This is the bill we passed.
Oh, wait a minute. Excuse me. This is the second bill. That was
2208.
Right. This is the second bill that we passed out that we didn't take to the floor, but we're having problems with bills, and I had a discussion with the chair of the Judiciary Committee prior to the time that we even heard these bills, and we should have coordinated with him due to the fact that the statute that this bill and the bill that we had the problem with, that statute has other bills that are in coming to us and also to judiciary that we need to deal with our staff and their staff so that we don't get ourselves in the kind of mess we got in the other day on the floor. So in order to ensure that that doesn't happen again, we're going to bring this bill back, hopefully, and then Steve will get together with their counsel and make sure that we're online when we go back to the floor.
We're talking 2213 or 2208?
2213 in this case.
2208 is already done.
We referred 2208 by action on the floor, and I'm very anxious to see what they're going to do with that particular bill. But we are.
Well, didn't we get that back here, though?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, what's it got to do with the other one you're talking about?
Well, we'd have the same problem with 2213 that we had with 2208 if we don't bring it back and coordinate so that since we're dealing with the same statute, which is 809, with a number of bills. We want to make sure that we don't intrude one on the other, because they have bills in judiciary that are involved in the same statute, and if we don't coordinate, then we're just going to have the same kind of a problem that we had to introduce these bills in the first place. Any further discussion? The motion is that the committee reconsider the February 12, 1987 vote, whereby House Bill 2213 was reported from this committee with a due pass as amended recommendation to the floor of the House.
The effect of the motion would be to...
Yeah, no further action is then required on the bill. So move. I move. We need a roll call on this one, Pamela.
Point of order, Mr. Chairman. We are reconsidering the motion by which it was passed to the floor
of
the House.
Right, that's all we do.
This doesn't mean we're returning it to the floor of the House. It means that...
No.
We're
not at this
tabling
point.
It or keeping it here.
We still have the bill.
All right.
Pamela, will you call the roll, please?
Representatives Brigiotti.
Aye.
Hayden.
Aye.
Jolin.
Yes, indeed.
Norris?
Yep.
Yep.
Peterson?
Aye.
Young?
Aye.
Whitty?
Motion passed. House Bill 2213 is back with us. Now we'll move to a public hearing and work session on House Bill 2160. 2160, as you remember, we heard on Tuesday, is the request from the Traffic Safety Commission to, or Traffic Safety Division to increase the endorsement on the license for motorcycles from $2 to $3 for the original endorsement. And then we have amendments to move the fee from 3 to 5. And it was in testimony, it was brought to us the fact that the original, the cost of the classes, it runs about $100 per person that is enlisted in the class, and it's paid for out of two pots. One, fees from those that are participating in the class, and I believe it's $30 for the original, the beginners, and $20 for the advanced, and then the rest is made up out of these, the endorsement money. And there hasn't been enough there with the original fee structure, and they've been running out of money in late August and September and that part of the year. But there are still people that need the class, and therefore they are either self-taught or have a friend teach them, and that's where I believe the testimony said 92% of the accidents come from that group. So this would enable the Traffic Safety Commission to staff to take care of that problem and run the classes through most of the rest of the summer. Now, I think we need a motion to amend.
Mr. Chair, before that motion, I wonder, apologize I wasn't here on Tuesday, and you've explained it fairly clearly. I have just a question or two, and one, I see on the back of one of the flyers that we received, mm-hmm. that this is available, these classes, through community colleges. Are these available throughout the state? Are they available in Southern Oregon? I don't see any community college from Southern Oregon.
Stan, will you come up and identify yourself, please, and give us that?
And I'm sorry if you have to repeat anything, but I need to.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Stan Porter from the Traffic Safety Commission. I'm the Motorcycle Safety Coordinator. The on the back of that pamphlet, the only site that is not listed is Portland Community College, Sylvania Campus. However, you'll note there's a mobile program at the bottom of the list. And that mobile program goes to the rest of the state that's not on that list with the Experienced Rider course. At this time, we are not able to fund a mobile beginning program that we could take to the rest of the state. And yes, we do have programs in Medford. We have been there for the last 3 years. We used to have a site at Rogue Community College campus, but we ran out of local dealer support. There just weren't that many dealers down there that had the money to help with the loan bikes and things.
And is that a program that happens on a monthly basis? I mean, it's available.
That's what we try to do, offer a beginning and an experience course at each one of those sites each month. During the first part of the season, we would like to offer two per month at each one of those sites, because we have people standing in line during the first part of the summer when the riding season starts that we just can't get them in until, you know, later on down the road.
And one last question. Were there any cyclists who testified on Tuesday? Any individual cyclists who think this is a wonderful idea?
We didn't have any testimony from cyclists, no.
Okay, but the assumption is, if I may ask, that because there are long lines and people are so anxious to get in, that this would not be a difficulty for.
Well, there was a member of the representing the governor's Motorcycle Safety Advisory Committee who is the one that has asked to raise it from the $3 to the $5 here, and that committee made that proposed amendment with the wishes of the motorcyclists.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 2160 with amendments to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
I think we need to make the amendment.
The amendment first. Yeah, have we the amendments?
Right. Yeah, we need to. I think what we're hoping to do here this morning is to merge the two bills because they're so similar that I think we'd be wasting a lot of time if we just, you know, had carried both bills to the floor, and if we could merge the bill with the second part of the package is 2161, which deals with mopeds, and it has to do with the class five addition of class five to the statute. Why don't we deal with that now so that we can get those two together?
Now, is that part of the amendments then to actually?
Well, yeah, I think the first thing we need to do is to put the bills together.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hayden.
I prefer the first thing we do is deal with the amendment. I'm not in favor of the amendment. I am in favor of the bills.
I think we'll just leave them. Representative Hayden, would you rather just leave them separate?
Mr. Chairman, I don't care what protocol is followed, but I would like to vote separately on the amendment to increase fees.
I think if we just keep the bill separately as they are, it might simplify the process, and even though it might be a slightly more complicated on the floor.
All right.
We'll just keep them separately, and then some members may wish to vote yes on one and no on the other. So right. We'll just deal with 2160, and so a motion to amend is in order on 2160.
Mr. Chair, I would move the amendments to 2160. I'm not sure how they're identified here. With cyclists on top.
They are as follows. Page 1, line 32, delete 3 and insert 5. Page 2, line 1, delete 3 and insert 5. That's the full amendment. Representative Peterson has moved House Bill 2160 to be amended as I just indicated. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hayden.
This amendment may be technically correct as written, although I don't understand it. Current law says that the motorcycle endorsement fee is $2.
Yeah,
that's right.
In line 32, the amendment says that we're raising it from 3 to 5. Actually, we're raising it from 2 to 5. Am I correct?
Well, on the bill itself does the raising, and we haven't moved the bill as yet. So we don't have the, actually, technically, what you said is true. That is the full extent of the legislation.
So really, we can't. This amendment is incorrect as written.
Well, the bill as printed shows a $3 fee, and we're amending the bill as printed to $5.
I think that's procedurally flawed, but it's a minor thing. I think that these courses are a good thing. I would like to take these courses, and I would like to have my children who are interested in riding motorcycles take these courses. I don't like the idea of ratcheting up the fees 250%. We do that here in one part of our jurisdiction. We do it there in another part of our jurisdiction. We're continually ratcheting up fees, doubling fees, and saying, people need to do this because people need to pay this because they're the users. And eventually we've doubled all the fees in the state. So we've doubled our tax load, and that's how taxes are increased. I think this should be done. I think it should be done within existing revenues. I believe that the Transportation Department and the Department of Motor Vehicles has adequate funds to do this. I think that a gun is being held to my head saying we need motorcycle safety, so I have to vote for a 250% fee increase. I don't like that. I want the courses. I don't want the fee increase.
For the committee's, thank you. For the committee's information, the fee was originally $3, and in the changeover from the Department of Education to the Department of Motor Vehicles, when we moved the training course, there was a typographical error made that moved it back to $2. And is that not correct, Stan?
That's what we think.
And so, in fact, what we're doing is increasing it two-thirds, 67%. Is there any other discussion on the motion? Pamela, will you call the roll, please?
Representative Hayden?
No.
Norris?
Aye.
Peterson?
Aye.
Young?
Aye.
Grigiotti?
Aye.
Jolin?
Aye.
Witte?
Aye. House Bill 2160 is amended. Can I have a motion then to move 2160?
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 2160 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Peterson moves House Bill 2162 to the floor as amended with due pass recommendation. Any final discussion? Pamela, call the roll, please.
Representatives Norris?
Aye.
Peterson?
Aye.
Young?
Aye.
Grigiotti?
Aye.
Hayden?
No.
Jolin?
No.
Witte?
Aye. If there's no one volunteering, I will carry the bill. I haven't carried one yet.
I think you can?
I think I can handle it.
Okay.
All right. We will open the public hearing on the House Bill 2161. And we have amendments again. House Bill 2161 deals with mopeds. Apparently there are people that have a moped license only and don't have endorsements. Stan, will you come up and give us a quick quickie again, since Representative Peterson wasn't here, so we can deal with this bill.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Stan Porter from Traffic Safety Commission. Presently, the Motor Vehicles Division has, excuse me, has the classified license system. The moped license, there used to be a moped-only license in it there before the classified system. Now it's called a Class 5 license. And a person that holds one of these is a person that does not drive a car, does not have a driver's license, does not drive a motorcycle, does not have a license to endorse. They just only use a moped. And under their classification, a moped is 50 cc's or under and doesn't go over 30 miles an hour. So that could be the scooters also, some of the small scooters.
Yes, these licenses are in reverse order as far as their the ability needed.
Right.
In other words, five is just simply a moped. Four is the one that almost all of us have. Everybody has to have a four to get a three, and then so forth. That's the way it works.
Yeah, I would move the amendments to House Bill 2161 as hand engrossed in the original bill.
Representative Young moves the amendments to House Bill 2161 as hand engrossed on the original bill. Is there any discussion?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Representative Jolin.
Well, I may ask you to come back up. I guess I'm a little cautious simply because I carried the bill in 83 to further define mopeds, whether they have pedals or not. What are we doing exactly? Will you explain that again? I'm not totally clear.
Presently, the moped license holder pays $2 into the Student Driver Education Fund of the Department of Education, where he gets no training on his moped. There is no school in the state of Oregon that trains moped riders. And a person that's out of the high school system cannot go back into high school to receive training. There's rules against that, all right? However, we are training moped riders and receiving zero funds from licensing or endorsements. All we get from them is the fee. So whenever one of those people comes to our classes, which cost them $30, then the motorcyclists of Oregon are paying the other $70 for that person to take our course.
So you're transferring the funds. You're not making any changes in the requirements of licensure?
No. It's just the instead of them paying into the Student Driver Ed Fund, it goes into the Motorcycle Fund, where then...
Yes, as Stan said, the motorcyclists are subsidizing with the endorsement on their driver's license. They're subsidizing the moped people that are taking the same class currently. Representative Peterson, did you have?
No, my question got answered, actually.
Fine. Any further discussion?
Yeah, while you're here, have you provided us with information that shows that states that have the training have substantially better safety records in states that don't? I know we're not looking at whether the program should be run or not, but it would be helpful when people ask us why we're including more people in paying for it and raising the fees to say we're doing it because it really works.
Well, if I could, I'd like to have some help from my research specialist at this time. It's Steve Garrett from Oregon State University. We have a grant with Oregon State University with training and research, and Steve is a Motorcycle Safety Foundation chief instructor, and he's also the chair of the State Coordinators Council, and I think he's, as far as the research end, is more qualified to answer that question.
Chairman, Representative Young, members of the council, how can I help you? Would you repeat the question again, please? My name is Steve Garrett.
Yeah, we haven't gotten any information that I'm aware of on whether the program is effective or not.
The program, there are two ways of looking at it. The military, the Air Force, has the exact same type of program that we're conducting here in Oregon. It's mandatory for all the people that are in the Air Force that ride motorcycles to take these courses, the identical courses that we offer. They have had a dramatic reduction in accidents, injuries, fatalities. I think it's the figures were about 35% over the last 5 years. It's continually dropped since they've mandated that everybody take the course. We can't mandate that everybody take the course. That's not in it. It's a voluntary situation. So we can't really verify what the records are as far as the reduction unless we have a total picture, unless we have everybody taking the course. Right now, the programs that Team Oregon does offer is not only do we offer programs on a voluntary basis, we're working with the courts through a court referral system to get those people that are violators into these programs, and that, I feel, is going to have a tremendous success because the age bracket, the 18 through 24-year-old typical male, are the ones that are overrepresented in accidents, and those are the ones that we need to get in the course, and those are the same ones that are less likely to take it on a voluntary basis.
Mr. Chair, are there some states that offer nothing where we could get a comparison of deaths and injuries and...
Yes, there are some states. Right now, there are 25 state-funded programs similar to Oregon's that run programs identical to what we do here. And then there are the other remaining 24 states that are not offering any programs at all.
Are we doing better than those states?
You're wanting to verify it as far as accident data? We can go, is that what you're looking for?
Right. If we're putting a lot of money into the program, and granted it comes from those people that buy motorcycles, but do we have any hard data that says that it's an effective?
There was a study done in New York State, Representative Young, over a 5-year period where they mandated that everybody that came in and got an endorsement on their driver's license for motorcycles would be put into a control group, and some of them would take the motorcycle rider course similar to ours, some of them would not. There were 4 distinct groups. They are currently analyzing that data, and they should have that out this year, they promised me. And that was funded by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration.
Could you say that we get a copy of that when it's out?
Yes.
Thank you.
We'll do.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hayden.
An anecdote, if I may. When people want to fly an airplane, they take a course before they fly that airplane. And then they pass a test before they fly that airplane by themselves. I had a dental patient come to my office once. He bought a great big motorcycle. He took it out into a vacant lot the first 5 minutes that he bought it, busted up himself, the motorcycle, his teeth, and everything. Humpty Dumpty. Just busted it up. And no insurance, of course, because he just got it. No insurance on the bike, no health insurance. Here's this guy all busted up because he had no idea how to handle that bike. He was a great big man, too, a big strapping fellow, you know, macho. He could handle it. Maybe people should have a little instruction before they take those bikes out and turn them up to 80 miles an hour.
I'm sure you're right, and I know that would happen to me if I ever got on one. But that's one thing I'm never going to do. No, I'll not do that. What is the procedure? I know you're not with DMV, but what is the procedure for the endorsement, getting the endorsement on a Class 4? What does a person do? Can you tell me?
There is Dennis Rice is in the audience for motor vehicles. He's with the licensing division, and I think he can answer that better than we can.
Mr. Chairman, Dennis Rice from Motor Vehicles Division. To get a motorcycle endorsement, an applicant has to pass a written test, 25-question multiple-choice test, a vision screening, and then an on-cycle test. We presently use the Motorcycle Safety Foundation's what they call the alternate most test to test the skill, riding skill, that mainly checks the ability to brake and to take evasive action. The 2 major causes of most motorcycle accidents is the inability of motorcyclists to be able to properly brake and to properly take evasive action. So that's the 2 things that our test is, you know, really geared to test.
You mean the examiner actually gets on the bike with the...
No, the examiner stands... It's an off-street test. And the examiner stands in a position where he can observe.
I was
going to
say they should get hazard pay if they get on one of those things like that.
Does every state have an endorsement?
Mm-hmm. Representative Young, all but 3.
Okay. Do we have a substantially better safety record because we require an endorsement over states that don't? And if not, then why? Why require the endorsement if it's not serving the purpose?
Representative Young, Steve Garrett's from Oregon State University. We do have a better record than those states. If you want to look at the accidents per 1,000 endorsed riders, we do have a better accident record than those states do. You have so many variables when you're figuring accident data. For example, some of the southern states that have a lot of population of military, the army bases in some of the southern states, they have a tremendous accident record, and yet you have to have an endorsement. So it just depends upon the geographical area of the state and the number of riders. Why don't you look that up?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I might add also that the state of California did a very in-depth study here a few years ago, just comparing the quality of 2 tests. They didn't compare, you know, no test, but they compared the Motorcycle Safety Foundation's MOST test, the Motorcycle Off-Street Skill Test, to a previous test that they had used, which was just sort of a little ride around in circles test. And I think they found that something like the accidents were reduced 20% by those who passed a more difficult skill test.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hayden.
I read somewhere within the last couple of weeks, I don't remember where, probably most of you read it too, maybe it was in the newspapers, that our system of testing motorcycle riders in the state of Oregon is to send them around the block, and if they come back alive, they get an endorsement.
At one time, that was probably true. Not for about the last 6 or 8 years.
Mr. Chair. Yes, Representative. Yes.
I don't have a problem with the bills or the program, but I think we're to a point eventually where we're going to have to say, is it worth the time and effort and substantial money? I've been away from this committee for a year, but I was shocked that it's $23 or so to get that endorsement. And it would be a shame to have that, be running a $100 a person training program and not be able to show, I think, substantial improvements. I mean, and it sounds like such a good idea that, I mean, you hate to question it, but I think you have to show that it's worth that time and money to in terms of number of accidents and that sort of thing.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Young, stamp order again.
Representative Peterson.
Well, I'm new on this committee, and I don't have biases one way or the other yet. I'm certain I will get them.
You're working on it?
But I do have some questions to ask, and maybe we'll get there in the chart. But if there are some almost 30,000 truckers that are now overloading, and they're paying, what, 7 cents a pound overweight, can you give me a sense of how much you took in terms of overweight violation money the last year, and then how much is estimated it costs to repair roads? I mean, is there any comparison here?
Representative Peterson, Mr. Chairman, first, the fine schedule is built on a graduated basis. Not all overloads pay the 7 cents a pound. The 7 cents a pound under the present system doesn't come into play until they're more than 5,000 pounds overloaded.
5,000 pounds?
Yes.
Okay.
This will be explained on one of these charts, too. As far as the amount of money that was collected by fines, I don't have that information. I would be glad to attempt to get it for you.
I appreciate that.
Can we proceed with the charts so we can see what an explanation is in order here on the way these things work, because I don't really understand. I've been looking at them.
For the record, I'm Ken Everett, Oregon State Highway Division.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is Schedule 1. Doug has indicated they are attached to the back of your testimony. I'd like to point out the two axes on the scale. We've had dollar figures over here for $100 increments, and the overweight on the bottom of 1,000-pound increments. The proposed fine is in the dotted line. The present fine is in the solid line. Presently, up to 1,000 pounds of overweight is $2 under our present fine system. 1,000 to 2,000 pounds of overweight is $15, and 2,000 to 3,000 pounds of overweight is 1 cent a pound. From 3,000 to 5,000, it goes to 2 cents a pound, and above 5,000 pounds, it's 7 cents a pound. Under the proposed schedule, up to 1,000 pounds would be $20. From 1,000 to 3,000 pounds would be 2 cents a pound. From 3,000 to 5,000 pounds would be 4 cents a pound. 5,000 to 7,500 pounds would be 6 cents a pound. From 7,500 to 10,000 pounds would be 8 cents a pound. From 10,000 to 12,500 would be 10. And above 12,500 would be 13 cents a pound. There is a sample on the right-hand side of the handout indicating proposed versus the present schedule and the amounts for the overweight. I might point out that from 5,000 to 7,500 pounds under the proposed schedule, the fine actually does decrease. An example of that would be at 7,000 pounds of overweight now, the present citation is $409. Under the proposed schedule, it would be 420.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Norris.
Mr. Chairman, on the violations that are cited, do you have any feel for what percentage or are 1,000 pounds or less, or are we talking a whole bunch of violations above 5,000 pounds excess, or most of them just marginal? Somebody goofed and threw on three too many boxes, or are these getting up into the 10,000 pound overweight up into these large figures? Do we find many truckers that are in that situation?
Representative Norris, Mr. Chairman, to answer your question, for the most part, we do not issue citations for 1,000 pounds or less. We just verbally warn.
And you said there had been over 50,000 citations issued last year?
Around 30,000 in 1986. To further answer your question, I would say that the largest percentage of our violations would be 3,000 pounds or less. Then there would be quite a few up to 5,000. From 5,000 to 10,000, we still have what I could say would be a lot of citations.
Are these generally detected when truckers voluntarily pull into the chicken coop, as they say on the TV?
Not always. To continue, above 10,000 pounds, we still have a lot of violations. Most of these violations above 10,000 pounds and a good percentage of the violations above 5,000 pounds are not trucks that will just come into the weigh station on their own. They often are trucks that find alternate bypass routes and we catch them out doing that, or we are on portable scales or what they refer to as jump scales where we weigh them at appropriate spots alongside the road.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Eden.
Can you explain to me, please, sir, on page 2, line 28, how it occurs that you can have a failure or refusal to stop for and submit to measurement or weighing? How is that possible?
Representative Hayden, Mr. Chairman, this happens quite frequently. If a truck driver knows that they are considerably overweight, the fine for refusing to weigh can often be less than the fine for going ahead and weighing the truck.
You mean if they bypass the scale?
No, that would be a person, once we stop them, that refused to weigh or refused to weigh. Also, a truck that does not want to come in and weigh, that tries to bypass or attempts to bypass the scale, we can issue a citation for failure to stop for weighing. If we feel that it was intentional, then yes, we do issue those citations. Does that answer the question?
No. Let me try one more time.
Representative Aiden.
Your enforcement officers or a state patrol officer or whoever is doing the enforcement, the waymaster with their cars with the lights, they'll be behind a truck and they'll turn that light on and the truck won't stop? Is that what happens? And they'll say, no, I'm not going to be weighed?
Representative Hayden and Chairman, Mr. Chairman, the law states that when a truck passes a highway that has a weigh station, open sign, they shall come in. Oftentimes at night, they will turn their lights off and just go by the weigh station, hoping that we don't see them. Oftentimes they will just go by the weigh station real fast and try to blend into traffic. When this happens and we can chase them down, they will stop for our red light. If they don't stop for our red light, we do have radio contact with the state police and can often get them to stop the truck. Once under this situation we have stopped the truck, then the driver is usually cooperative and there is no problem with issuing the citation for failing to stop.
Well, one more question, please.
Representative Hayden, go ahead.
You know, the fine for a 1,000-pound overload is $2 now, and which is, you know, probably tolerable. it's going to go up 1,000% under this bill, 1,000% increase to $20, and that's quite an increase percentage-wise. But a $1,000 fine for failing to stop, would it ever be possible that a driver would be just a little overweight, maybe 500 or 1,000 pounds overweight, and I don't suppose there's anybody out there that would harass a driver and stop him 6 or 7 times until the guy finally said, hey, I'm just not going to take this anymore. And then they get a $1,000 fine.
No. Representative Hayden and Mr. Chairman, when a truck goes by the scale, for the most part, unless there's extenuating circumstances where it is night and they have turned off their lights and we do feel that it was intentional, we will give the operator the opportunity to return to the scale and weigh prior to writing that citation. If the truck weighs legal, there would be no citation. If the truck had a 2,000-pound overload or whatever, that would be the citation under normal circumstances.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I guess what I need is sort of what I asked about before. If you could do some sort of gathering of information or graph in terms of from 1981 on, how many vehicles in each of these categories and what the fines were and how much they were overloaded. I mean, I'm trying to look at this from a very logical mm-hmm. standpoint as, you know, how serious is the problem, and that would be helpful to me.
Representative Peterson and Mr. Chairman, to gather the data on how many trucks were weighed and what type citations were issued, we could do that very easily. Once we turn the citation into the court, at the present time, we have no system to track what fine was assessed on that citation. The last information that we have of that type, if I'm not mistaken, was in 1984. Since 1984, we have no information of that type.
Well, perhaps then just the first part of the question. How many in each category? So I can see it in terms of raw numbers. Are we talking about, in terms of overweight vehicles, how many around the state are overweight by 10,000 pounds as opposed to how many overweight at 1,000 pounds? Can you?
Yes, we would be glad to furnish that information.
I have a request, too. I'm just wondering if over 10,000 pounds, if there is a particular type of truck carrying a particular type of load, particular logs, that might be more inclined to be over that limit. Are log trucks more likely to be over 10,000 than others, or is that not true?
Mr. Chairman, I would say that's not true. Log trucks do have scales on them, and for the most part, log trucks do attempt and do a very good job of staying within the limits.
Ever get a chip truck over?
Yes.
How did they, because the load is wet?
Yes, because the load is wet. Oftentimes they tell us that whatever's in the hopper is what they have to take. Once they open the door, it falls into it. And then you go back to the what are we going to do about it then. And our feeling is that this is not a responsibility that the Highway Division or our highway should have to stand up to. This should be the responsibility of the trucking company.
Thank you. We can proceed with the chart.
Whoever, please.
In addition to increasing the fines for violations of the statutory weight limits, this permit will increase fines for violations of variance permits issued for weight. This is under Schedule 2. Our variance permit system originated out of a recognition that some essential commodities, such as specialized logging and farm equipment, could not meet statutory weight limits. When the oil embargo of the early 70s threatened to disrupt the orderly flow of goods on our highway system, this permit procedure was expanded to allow additional gross weight for more cost-effective movement of divisible commodities on multi-unit vehicles such as double and triple trailer combinations. Recognizing that loads operating above the statutory limits do contribute to accelerated pavement and bridge damage, the fine for violating the weight limits of a variance permit must be higher than Schedule 1. They're covered in Schedule 2, and at this time, Ken will go over Schedule 2 with you.
Yeah.
So Schedule 1 is for just the violations of general overweight over length
of statute, right.
Okay, and then Schedule 2 is for violations of the weights and lengths, et cetera, imposed upon you when you get a variance permit to operate.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, one question.
Yes, Madam Representative Chair. Young.
What about somebody that is simply just overweight in terms of what their PUC for and are not overweight in terms of the axle weight?
Representative Young, this is an area that the state police covers and not us. We do issue citations for no PUC permit, but only if they absolutely don't have a permit. If they do exceed what their declared weights are, they can be issued a citation for exceeding declared weight permits, but this would have to be by a police officer. A Waymaster does not do this.
Okay. That's new to me. I didn't
excuse
understand
me, Madam Chairman.
Yes.
I didn't understand how that worked.
The issue came up here that these schedules pertain to overweight, overheight, overwidth. The only thing to legend I see on here pertains to overload or overweight. How would you translate overload into overheight and overwidth?
Representative Norris, Madam Chair, we did not make up a chart on the overweight or overwidth. There is some testimony.
Okay,
that
we're strictly looking then at overweight, i.e.
Yes,
overload,
the three,
right?
The three charts cover statute weight, which is Schedule 1, variance permit or heavy haul permit, as it's often called, extended weight permit, which are permits that allow excess weight. The third chart, before we get to it, covers restricted highways or restricted bridges that we have had to impose some type of a weight restriction on.
Thank you.
Okay.
Are there other questions? Continue, please.
So Ken, did we go over Schedule 2?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this is Schedule 2. The proposed fine is once again in dotted line. The present fine is in a solid black line. Under our present Schedule 2, there is only one fine. It's $100 plus 10 cents a pound for any violation of the permit itself. What we propose under Schedule 2 is to make no change before there's more than a 5,000 pound overload. So from 100 to 5,000 pounds overloaded, there would be no change from the $100 and 10 cents a pound. Under the proposed Schedule 2, from 5,000 to 10,000 pounds, we propose $250 fine plus 15 cents a pound for overweight. From 10,000 or to above 10,000 pounds, the fine would be $500 plus 30 cents per pound, a pound overweight.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Young.
Now, these are only in cases where somebody has already applied and paid for a permit to be overweight.
Representative Young, Madam Chair, yes, this would be true.
And if you've applied for 5,000 pounds overweight, then the chart starts at being 5,001 pounds overweight. Or
how,
for 1 pound over your permitted overweight.
How these overweight permits work, we have basically two type of overweight permits. One is to allow a non-divisible one unit, one piece, such as a D8 CAT, to get from point A to point B. On those type of a permit, we will allow a maximum of 21,500 pounds on an axle, which is 1,500 pounds more than statute. 43,000 we will allow on a tandem axle, which is 9,000 pounds more than statute allows. And then the gross weight goes by a wheelbase formula. More wheelbase, the more axles, the more weight they can haul. This is the type of permit we're talking about. We've already granted them 9,000 extra pounds.
Right.
If they exceed that, the fine, in our opinion, has to be stiffer.
I'd like to interrupt for just a minute and welcome students from Faith Christian School in Woodburn today. We're talking about vehicles on our highways, large trucks. the possibility of raising the fee if they are traveling on our highways overweight, what this does to the truckers and what this does to the highways. So if you came in the middle, it might be a little hard to follow, but we welcome you and we're glad you're here today. Thank you. Please continue.
Occasionally, our highway system is damaged by the forces of nature, such as the extreme cold of some eastern Oregon winters, or by accidents, such as the ship that recently struck the McCulloch Bridge near North Bend. Emergencies of this type often require reduction of weight limits until conditions change or repairs are made. Exceeding the maximum weight limits on a highway or structure that has had a weight restriction placed on it has the potential to be one of the most serious violations possible, as a structure could collapse or a highway could break up into rubble under the weight of an overloaded truck. Fines for violation of weight restrictions are imposed under Schedule 3. At this time, I'll have Ken explain Schedule 3.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, under our present Schedule 3, the fine for a violator for 100 pounds to 1,000 pounds of overweight is $50. From 1,000 to 2,000 pounds of overweight is 6 cents a pound. From 2,000 to 5,000 pounds overweight is 8 cents a pound. And above 5,000 pounds is 10 cents a pound. Under the proposed Schedule 3, from 100 to 5,000 pounds overweight would be $100 plus 15 cents a pound. From 5,000 to 10,000 pounds of overweight would be $250 plus 20 cents a pound. And above 10,000 pounds would be $500 plus 30 cents a pound.
Excuse me, Mr. Lee, you had a question?
Yeah, Madam Chair, thank you. Are weight restrictions on a road or bridge imposed by statute on particular roads, or is that something that is determined by rule? And if so, how do you do that?
There is a statute, and I don't have it in the top of my head, that does allow that to be done. And then it's done by the region engineer in the region that the highway is under.
On state highways?
On state highways.
Do counties and cities as the road authority also have the authority to do that?
Yes,
on their
they
roads?
Do.
Okay.
Excuse me just a moment. I'd like to welcome the people from the youth, what do you call yourself? Youth Legislature? Is that what it is?
Lebanon.
You're just Lebanon? You're not in that part of it?
No.
Is that, where are the others from?
Well, there are some of us.
I introduced the others.
Oh, you introduced the others. Oh, okay, fine. Thank you. Go ahead.
This bill also increases the fines for violations of vehicle size limits. Size violations present another major hazard to both structures and the motoring public. An overwidth or overheight vehicle or load may cause only minor damage, such as impeding traffic or hitting overhanging telephone lines. But the potential for far more serious damage exists, such as happened in late 1986 when an overheight movement struck an overpass outside of Portland, resulting in a death. Lastly, this bill changes some of the wording of the statute from "by a fine of not more than" to "the fine shall be." Violations of size and weight statutes are very serious. The potential for harm to the traveling public and costly damage to our highway system from oversized and overweight trucks is very real. The significance of the penalty for violating our size and weight laws will be restored by this bill, and we will be able to more effectively deter overloading.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm needing to know how it works on this Schedule 3. If there has been some sort of accident or the road has fallen off or broken up, how do truckers know ahead of time that they have to have their load reduced, that there's a problem before they get there with their overloaded?
Representative Peterson, Mr. Chairman, we are required by law to post the highway or road or structure at both ends of the structure and at any interceding roads, any roads that would come onto the road that's been restricted.
Well, I guess I still have trouble. If someone's traveling on a road from out of state and they get to the point where the road is in bad repair, and they've been carrying a load for, you know, so many hundreds of miles already, then what do they have to do? Do they physically have to stop and remove some of their load?
Representative Peterson, Mr. Chairman, they would either have to do that or normally they would find an alternate route.
Thank you.
Representative Joel.
When we have a bill like this in front of us where you are actually going to be raising revenue when all is said and done, what do you do with that additional revenue? And let me further explain my thinking. This is not revenue that you need to cover your cost necessarily, as are some fees that we tie to the cost of processing paper and et cetera. What would you do with this extra revenue?
Representative Jolin, Mr. Chairman, this revenue would go back into the general fund to be used to repair highways.
The highway fund?
Or the highway fund, excuse me.
Still dedicated money to highways.
Yes.
Thank you.
Representative Peterson.
I guess I'm interested in knowing if there's any kind of federal connection with overweight loads, if we're not getting certain amount of federal funds, if we're not abiding by federal laws which connect with state laws. Is there any kind of relationship?
Representative Peterson, Mr. Chairman, yes. We are required as the Waymaster unit of the Permits and Waymaster section, and as the Department of Transportation, to do two things each year that I know of on the top of my head for or in response to the Federal Highway Administration. Number one, by the 1st of October each year, we have to submit what we call, or they call, a size and weight plan, a plan of how we are going to control overloads and oversized vehicles here in Oregon. And then number two, we have to certify by the 1st of January each year that we are controlling overloads and overheights and overdimensional vehicles within Oregon. I am not familiar with the way money exchanges from federal to state, but this does affect the funds that are given the state of Oregon from the federal government for highway repair, highway construction.
So do the feds have to okay that plan? I mean, if they don't like it, do you have to go back and do it again?
I have never had one that was not accepted, and I'm not familiar what would happen if that did happen. I could find out
for
you.
I'd be interested in knowing if funds are withheld or just...
Excuse me, Ken Everett says that he has the ability to answer
Mr.
that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Peterson. That is true. Federal funds could be withheld if the federal government failed to approve Oregon's certification.
Steve, you have something to add?
Much of like the sanction would work with speed limits and the compliance. I mean, I'm assuming that this plan and your January reporting is to show that you're in compliance.
Correct.
Secondly, while we talked about road authority and your ability to restrict weights on state highways, who has the responsibility to decide what gets to travel on the interstate? Does the federal government say you do that too? Is this plan a part of the interstate system, your responsibility on the interstate, or do they have some weight restrictions on the interstate system within this state?
Mr. Chair, yes, it's primarily the interstate is what we're looking at. The federal government does give Oregon funds to maintain the interstate road system. In turn, they expect that a state will conform to federal weight limits, that we won't allow more than 20,000 pounds on an axle or 34,000 pounds on a tandem axle, and that we will maintain a gross weight primarily of 80,000 pounds. At the same time, that's part of the condition that we also have a size and weight enforcement program to make sure that those laws are obeyed, or otherwise we risk losing the federal dollars.
Mr. Chairman, if I may continue, but you do allow them, you know, how do you get to do it under the various permit system? You know, why do you get to do it if the law says you can't?
The federal government does allow us to issue variance permits, recognizing that there are some items that could not be moved any other way than by permit,
And the permit process allows us to control that movement safely so that the machinery or whatever it be can be moved safely with the least inconvenience to the traveling public and without destroying the road that it's going to be traveling on.
Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. But the federal government doesn't set the fines that you must assess.
No, Representative.
And a second question. Were we told the total amount of fines that you would collect in a biennium?
In dollars?
In dollars.
We have the number of violators, 29,000, but we don't know anything about how much revenue is.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hayden, we haven't collected that type of information since 1984. It's solely dependent upon the court that citation's put into as to far as what's the disposition of that case, how much fine will be collected. We don't have any current information of what the courts are actually collecting on the citations that we're issuing today. We do have some estimates from 1984, and that was the last time it was sampled. And at that time, the average or the approximate bail that was put on the citation by our enforcement officers was $60. At that same time, the average fine the courts were collecting was $40.
I'm sure we can get that information from the highway people or from Central Services.
Can't he just tell me how much it was in 1984?
If he knows, nice.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hayden, we do have some printouts on what happened in 84, but the problem we have there, we only have, the information indicates that a part of the citations were still in the system and had not been processed through. We do have some records that show about 18,000 of them of what the fines that were collected, just as total figures.
Mr. Chairman.
Well, Representative Young, I think you had a question. Did you have a question?
I think I do. Why don't you go on and
all right, Representative
this might have been answered a little bit ago, but if I'm a trucker and I'm loaded up in Portland and I've got to get over to Montana and I'm going to go from Portland and Oregon through Spokane, across over northern Idaho and into Montana, do I know that every one of those states have the same permissible maximum load? So when I start legal in Portland, and I can feel secure, I'm legal all the way to Missoula?
Representative Norris, Mr. Chairman, no, every state has different weight laws. And so it is the responsibility for a trucker or a trucker company to know the laws of the state that they are going to travel through.
What was said earlier about recognition of the federal